is access to the rural health clinics and community health centers for persons with disabilities. We have no disclosures to report. And first, I would like to acknowledge the Montana Disability Health Plan Group that developed the Accessibility Ambassador Program within the Montana Disability Health Program as a social marketing strategy. In the interest of time, I will refer you to more information about Accessibility Ambassadors on the Montana Disability and Health website, and I would like to acknowledge the significant contributions of the Montana Centers for Independent Living, the Montana Primary Care Association, and the Montana Department of Public Health and Human Services, Office of Primary Care. So this slide has a screenshot of the Accessibility Ambassadors webpage and includes a photo of two ambassadors measuring a surface slope of a building entrance. Maybe you have a text description on the previous slide. So for the overview, we suggest basic policy, training, and resource changes are needed to provide people with disabilities equal access to preventive health care and treatment services. So in 2010, roughly 39.5% of adults with disabilities self-rated their overall health as fair to poor compared to persons without disabilities, which was 8.7%. The Montana 2010 Burbit also showed this disparity in the Montana adult population with disabilities, with a similar comparison of 39% of adults with disabilities experiencing fair to poor health compared to 7% of adults without a disability. As evidenced by many of the studies being reported here at the conference, there are also a myriad of healthcare disparities experienced by populations with disabilities. So we present state data on these disparities in the Montana Disability Health Strategic Plan available on our website. So proposed Healthy People 2020 objective DH4 aims to reduce the proportion of people with disabilities reporting delays in receiving primary and periodic preventive care due to specific barriers. So attaining this goal requires increasing the capacity and knowledge of healthcare providers for people with disabilities, as well as increasing the accessibility of healthcare facilities for people with disabilities. Okay. So increasing healthcare access to healthcare through community health centers and rural health clinics is a primary objective for the Montana Disability and Health Program. Funded under the U.S. Public Health Service Act, CHCs utilize federal grants to provide care and service to underinsured, uninsured, and underserved people. Under the rules of operation set forth by the Secretary of Health and Human Services, RHCs provide services to underserved rural communities, and direct reimbursement is given to existing medical practices for costs on Medicaid and Medicare patients. There are currently 50 RHCs and 27 CHCs, including CHC satellites in Montana. So a CHC can be either a nonprofit or public facility, whereas an RHC can be either a for-profit or not-for-profit facility. CHC is required to have a board of directors, so at least over half the board members also being patients of the facility. The CHC is required to provide a full range of primary care and preventive services for all age categories. Under the Affordable Care Act Development Grant, healthcare facilities have the opportunity to receive one-time grants to support existing healthcare facilities to improve capacity to provide primary care and preventive services to underserved populations. So Accessibility Ambassadors conducted on-site assessments of 18 CHCs and 29 RHCs for a total of 47 assessed clinics statewide using the Massachusetts Facility Assessment Tool and a supplemental tool developed with the Montana Disability Health Community Planning Group. That was actually developed by the Montana Community Planning Group, Ambassadors, the Office of Primary Care, and the Montana Primary Care Association. Okay, so this is a brief description of the layout of the MFAT, short for Massachusetts Facility Assessment Tool. So there are four priority areas. Priority area one is accessible approach and entrance. Priority area two is access to goods and services. Priority area three is accessible restrooms. And last, priority four is additional access. So in this example, the item service area in priority area 2, access to goods and services, consists of 13 elements, including reception, intake counter, waiting area, doors, hall corridors, carpeting, protruding objects, controls, dressing room, alternative changing area, exam room and accessible exam table, mammography machine and accessible weight scales, and last waiting room. These are the text description of the previous slide. And so we created a map of Montana that shows the 29 counties with participating CHDs and RHDs. So icons indicate the location of community health centers and rural health clinics that participated in this project. The triangle indicates the RHD, and the star indicates the CHD. So this map shows the statewide reach of this project. Here is the text description following the map. And so a bar chart titled Priority Area 1, Accessible Approach and Entrance, shows elements along the x-axis and the percentage found accessible along the y-axis. So of the 7 elements for accessible approach and entrance, the location of an accessible parking space was most commonly observed in 73% of the participating clinics, while car accessible and then accessible parking spaces were only observed in 9% of the participating clinics. There's a description to describe this bar chart. So for priority area 2, this bar chart titled Priority Area 2, Access to Goods and Services, again shows elements along the x-axis and the percentage found accessible along the y-axis. So of the 5 elements for access to goods and services, directional signage was most commonly observed in 34% of the participating clinics, while an accessible service area was observed in 0% of the participating clinics. Following the text description of the bar chart. So this bar chart titled Priority Area 3, Accessible Restrooms, and Priority Area 4, Additional Access, shows the element for accessible restroom was observed, again, 0% in the participating clinic. For additional access, an accessible drinking fountain was most commonly observed in 19% of the participating clinics, while an accessible telephone was observed in 0% of the participating clinics. Following the text description of the bar chart. So these data compel action. 0% is definitely a low point to have. So we detailed a plan for each clinic called an accessibility action plan. These plans were provided to each RHC and CHC, listing the barriers that were present with some possible solutions. Subsequent columns prompted assignment of a timeline and responsible party for implementing solutions. Finally, there is a progress column to record the facility's accomplishments in addressing each defined barrier. Some barriers will require minimal efforts to address, such as just rearranging the furniture in an exam room to provide an adequate clear floor space, whereas other barriers will need to be integrated into long-term strategic plans, such as purchasing a new exam table itself. So resources and materials were compiled into a toolkit that was provided to each clinic and its action plan, with its action plan. So the resource toolkit consisted of a list of resources, contact information, and selected documents. So in our follow-up evaluation, postcard responses indicated the following. The project was rated as helpful to very helpful on a 5-point scale. Facilities strongly agreed to increase staff training on access to healthcare for people with disabilities. And 50% were very likely to provide public comment for the U.S. Access Board proposal for access standards for medical diagnostic equipment. And on a positive note, the most exciting follow-up report from clinics was that 3 eligible clinics included objectives from their accessibility action plans in their funded U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Portable Capital Development Grant application. So here is one quote provided by Key Managed Partnership Health Center, who received the grant and also had the accessibility study. It has been a pleasure to work with you. We were able to incorporate your entire list of ADA needs for our building into our capital development facility improvement grant to HRSA. we receive that grant funding and will be able to incorporate those ADA improvements in our model. We care about accessibility. It is in our mission statement.
Thank you. Of course, the obvious question is, why didn't others do that? You know, if there's a grant source to do these capital improvements that have been pointed out to them. But we'll have that in the discussion. But I think it's interesting this morning that we had three very different presentations, one using the maps, which we all have access to, a very large and robust publicly available data source to answer questions of importance to people with disabilities. We had a very interesting survey of healthcare providers, a group that allow us access into the clinics to do these surveys, the administrators of the practices, not the providers of care, but the administrators of the practice, which I think is a very, very important group. And then finally, we heard about going out into the community, doing these surveys, and looking at what we find and what we can do about what we find, what the options are. So with that, please, there's right there is a microphone, and please ask the panel some questions.
Hi, my name is Amanda Rinkert. I'm at the University of Kansas, and my comment is for Dr. Miller. My colleagues and I have also looked at the MAPS data in a similar way to what students try to implement, but we subdivided it according to type of disability, and we do find important differences across different types of disability, physical disability, cognitive limitations, and sensory impairments. And at the same time, we looked at Medicaid administrative site data in a similar fashion, dividing it according to different types of disability, and finding important differences in service utilization and access for them services. And it just made me think, I take part to what Barbara Alden's approach, and I wonder if maybe we should merge the two. Because I think that the differences between the different disability groups are important because of the support systems that are in place for them and how they access health care. So we hadn't taken it to the level of applying the level of severity of the disability or complexity of the disability within each of those groups. I know then you have over 50 years of data for the MAPS, but to get big enough stuff like that. It was just an interesting thought, and I just wanted to point that out, that we are, with the work that we're doing, we really are starting to see how important it is to divide it into different disability subgroups, and because of issues of how people access healthcare supports and social supports and systemic supports that they have in place.
We initially started with the six different measures of disability and only moved somewhat recently to kind of creating broader categories. And when we were doing some of the initial work, we saw some important differences by type of disability. One of the issues, and it came out with our summary measures, and you see even more when you look at specific types of disability, is that there's many people have more than one type of disability, and so it's difficult to kind of create mutually exclusive like kind of categories of disability, and so a fair amount of work out there, at least kind of our reading of it, is you're looking at a person with a particular type of disability relative to a person without that disability. So you may not have a mobility disability, but they're not necessarily people without disabilities entirely. So we, in an effort to try to kind of create mutually exclusive categories and to have a clean, when we were looking at people with and without disabilities, we moved to Barbara Altman's approach, although we took hers a step further. The work that she does and is used in AHRQ doesn't create mutually exclusive categories. Our categories are mutually exclusive. Having said that, I think that there's a lot of work, because you do see very important differences across types of disabilities, and even with our three categories, there are very important differences between people, say, with basic versus complex limitations. So I think continuing to work with the measures and examining kind of those differences across types of disability and things is important work to do.
Hi, Suzanne Smeltzer from Illinois University. My question is for Dr. Farmer.
Yes.
Nice study.
Thank you.
But I have a question. I'm glad to identify the limitations, because one of the issues for sure is that people think they're accessible and they're not.
Right.
But my question actually is, and I may have missed this, but instead, what was your response rate? In other words, how many people out there didn't respond?
Okay, yeah, that's a great question. My response rate was probably point something percent, because in this management group organization, the number of providers who identified as being primary care was 1,683. We did send out the invitations to participate in the study through this e-communications portal. It's really hard to calculate an accurate response rate based on that, because I don't know how many people in that group, maybe, you know, during that time period. So it was a 3-week time period that we asked them to participate in the survey, kind of near the holidays, just based on my dissertation time frame. So how many people aren't members anymore but still maybe are listed on that e-communications portal? How many never go to their e-communication portal, because it's not an email that comes to your personal email address. You actually have to log on to the website and go to your portal and go through a number of layers. You know, how many people saw the email and said, I don't want to participate, you know, so there's no way to really say how many were non-contact, how many were refusals, you know, that sort of stuff. So the response rate was very low. But again, it's hard to say the response rate was this, because we weren't calling them on the phone, you know, marking, well, this person refused to participate, and we couldn't contact this person, or there's no way to really track that within the website.
My name is Kiyoshi, and I'm from the University of North Chicago. I have a question for both Jennifer and Nanette. First of all, that both of you take a very different approach. Jennifer, do the online stuff, kind of on-site business, right? So my question is also, one for Jennifer, following up Susan's comment, how many questions in your survey, how long it would take for the respondents to cover at this one of the questions are, and you already mentioned that very low response rate, but I just wonder, is there any room you can show me the question here and increase the response rate? That's my question to you. And for Helen, when Freud mentioned Helen, how long does it take to be one site start and visit, and how much human power or cost or time it takes to be a full survey of each of the quiz? I know you mentioned that you have done 47, 46, but 70, and I just want to figure out current state of the Montana to this type of inside visit, what resources we need to think about, particularly my state is relatively large compared to the Montana, so it helps us to think about what we need to think about. That's my question for each other.
So, great questions. My survey took about 40 minutes for the administrators to complete it. I'm just giving you what I thought was the most important finding from my dissertation, kind of broken down into three different areas. So the questions included, I used the adaptive environment checklist for existing facilities and only asked questions that dealt with mobility disabilities, so questions about like having audible fire sensors or blink, you know, flashing lights and that sort of thing. I eliminated those questions just to try to shorten the survey, because because it was such a long survey. The methods I used were mixed methods, so I included quantitative and qualitative questions. So, you know, it was a long survey, and, you know, I did need to let them know up front that it was going to take, you know, probably, you know, 40 minutes for them to complete the survey. So I'm sure several of them saw that and just said, I don't have 40 minutes to spend doing the survey. So, you know, mixed methods, your sample size isn't going to be as big as if you do strictly a quantitative survey. So, you know, 63 is probably a pretty good size for a mixed method survey, but again, a limitation is that it was, you know, a low sample size for doing quantitative evaluation that I wanted to do, and then I did have a low response rate. So,
how
I think the total number was around 70. More of them were quantitative questions, you know, just really, but you know, and there were several open-ended questions as well.
Okay, so for the onset assessments, I'm using the Massachusetts Disability Assessment Tool. In my personal experience, assessing a one-level disability took about 2 to 3 hours, and if it was a two-level disability, it took roughly possibly 3 to 5 hours to conduct a full assessment, including all the priority areas, and that was about 94 pages long. But it also included introductions and some background information and explanations of the items and elements. And across Montana, we have a total of 77 total RHDs and PhDs. And for this current project, we have conducted 29 out of the 50 RHDs and 18 out of the 27 PhDs. So, definitely, we partnered with the accessibility ambassadors from the Montana Center for Independent Living, and they're just dispersed throughout Montana. So what we did was assign them a given geographic area of clinics to contact and to ask to participate. So given their area, and of course, they conducted the majority of the assessments, and were trained by Montana Disability and Health staff. And
is there only one staff member required to be a second assistant, or needs to be a volunteer person, should be involved?
So it's definitely more than one staff member, just because of the length of the survey. Typically, accessibility ambassadors paired up in 2, sometimes 3 members. So they're available to complete the assessment in a much quicker time.
And I think that's an important question, Kiyoshi, but this is an investment from the CDC, their Disability Health Program, and it's a partnership with the CIL, so we're leveraging their disability community partnerships and promoting ADA accessibility. So we pay them, Montana, $25 an hour for the assessment, and we reimburse for mileage. So this project is pretty low cost. The outcomes are, in addition to increasing awareness of evidence-based resources and continuing education opportunities, it also includes building relationships between individual living centers and community health centers and rural health clinics, so that the referral both for assistance at a facility as well as to accessibility services or to healthcare is improved and increased. So it's a pretty low cost investment on the program part.
This is Catherine from South Carolina. One of the questions for Helen is, what was your feedback from your ambassadors in trying to get the assessment scheduled, their ability to actually get into the facility, or the feedback from not being able to get into the facility?
Yeah, so we're just informal talk, just to communicate nobody had much issues about being in the facility. They were very, very just inclined to get these assessments done, get the results back to us, and just show the lack of accessibility in the clinic that they actually were patients of. For instance, the Mapler and the Great Falls area show comment actually assessed one of the, I guess it was a community health center, where she actually was a patient, and it was somewhat accessible, but she was just very motivated and just aspired to get these assessments done. But it was relatively not much of an issue for their reports and any feedback they had received. And I don't know if maybe the verified with any issues.
Well, you're telling me the feedback from the ambassadors that the ambassador. I guess my question is, were the practices aware that the patients were assessing their facility?
Yeah, there was informed consent for the facilities.
So did you have any negative response from any of the facilities that said, what are you going to do with this?
Yes.
Who are you? Who do you?
We definitely had some.
What kind of feedback did you get, and how was that overcome?
We just basically made offered a broad explanation that all of this is going to be aggregated. They're being able to be kept confidential. And that this is for their benefit, that they're going to provide, we are going to give them resources and just to keep at their disposal. So.
And, you know, I think it's really important to say that this was with guidance from the Montana Primary Care Association, the Office of Primary Care. And the most resistance that we have is from the World Health Clinic, because that's such a heterogeneous mix. The PhDs belong to the Montana Primary Care Association. We have good information about how to approach them, and NPCA promoted the program to them. The Rural Health Clinic in the current cooperative agreement, we're partnering with the Montana Hospital Association, who is the organization to which most of the Rural Health Clinic belong. And so that is where we're going to be taking a statewide assessment, and that's where we're going to be most of the Rural Health Clinic working with this. And where we do suspect it will be, you probably can't get into a lot of the offices, so the answer will be a problem. But at this point, we've got enough rural health clinics so they know it's really an education program and activity that I'm
I had a question for Jennifer. I thought the results were interesting. I was just wondering if you could put these results in the context of some changes in physician practices that seem to be going on right now. Medicine used to be called the last private industry. That seems to sort of be coming through the change and sort of the corporatization and then ownership of physician practices by these larger entities. I was wondering what the implications of that might be. I mean, I can sort of see it go both ways, and that maybe these higher up entities, like if a hospital owns a physician practice, maybe there's a greater sense of responsibility to be living in the PDA than, you know, just practice,
yeah, and there could be some, you know, economies of scale kind of gain through that, you know, and economies of scale would be that if you have more providers in a clinic and you have more patients in a clinic, then the cost of that wheelchair accessible exam table or scale that can accommodate a wheelchair is spread over more providers and more patients, so the cost per provider and the cost per patient is lower. And so it makes it, you know, more readily achievable than maybe if you have a one or two physician practice where that cost of a headache on a simple exam table may really make you cost prohibitive for them. So you do see some other studies have found that, you know, hospitals tend to be more accessible than primary care facilities, or primary care facilities that are attached to a hospital tend to be more accessible than standalone, you know, away from a hospital facilities. So I do think that, you know, there could be this. By having, you know, ownership, larger ownership of these clinics, you may have more of an incentive to make sure that you are, you know, you do provide accessibility and that sort of thing. Like, you know, Kaiser's a big, you know, organization, and, you know, they had some lawsuits where they weren't being able to accommodate their patients, so they across our whole organization, you know, make steps to be more accessible. So that definitely would grab more attention than, you know, Dr. Smith, one, you know, physician practice, you know, not being compliant with the ADA, that probably wouldn't even make all the paper headline. We're not tied to that. That's a really big deal. So maybe we will see a move towards better accessibility, you know, as we kind of are moving in that direction. I just had a question. It seemed like you flashed up very quickly a website that has your toolkit, and
yes.
I was wondering if we could get that sort of right. Because I would love to have that. I mean, I think that's incredible information, and that'd be a great source.
Definitely.